Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. As always, I want to tell you the links. If you need to reach me and you can't do it via radio, email is a good choice. The way to reach me is my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. That would be for mailbag questions, topics for discussion, sharing puzzlers, technical puzzles. I like to kind of use them as learning instruments. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some NASA or space-related news, if you want to email Paul directly, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Have an interesting link page with all kinds of interesting articles. There are some articles that we could talk about. There are others that are more visual. There are some space-related ones that no doubt Paul will discuss. So the link page is roy.ac2gs.com. That's available 24/7. It stays there for years. So please take a look at the link page at your leisure. We have a chat room available. You can either go into Limark's own website and find the link and click it, or you can type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you a direct link to the chat room. We stream this on an audio stream on the Internet, so if you have friends who are outside of the radio range and can't log into Echolink, have them type in technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you an audio stream of the technical net, and I keep it live 24/7, so anything going out on Glen Oaks can be heard on the audio stream. And as always, I like to remind people of my KC2NJI's great archive site. It has archives of the technical net going as far back as September 2006. His site, amateurradio.tv, has over a million visitors, so avail yourself of the wisdom of many of amateur radio operators who've been talking on this technical net for years and years and years. Let me drop and I'll tell you my plans for the night. Okay, it's going to be a regular night. I'm going to ask for any technical questions. I would prefer if the people with amateur technology-related questions, come on and reserve a space first so that we could talk about the amateur radio technology. But we're open to any discussion of science and medicine. As always, we do not treat or diagnose, but if you have a question, we will try our best to answer it or to give you some idea of where to find out the answer. That should take us to 10:15, where Paul, WS2N, will present us with the SpaceNet report. That'll take us to 11 p.m. I will return to wish everyone a good week, put a bow on it, and call it a net. So that's the plans for tonight. If anyone out there has any technical questions, preferably of amateur radio-related technical questions, but like I said, we take them all. Please give me your first name and your call sign.
AB6MB.
Okay, Jeff on Echolink recognized, Rich recognized. Anyone else want to put their name and call sign on the list for tonight? Okay, well, we'll start with the list that we have. First up is Jeff, AB6MB. Jeff is the net control operator for the Papa Systems weekly antenna net. It meets every Friday night at 10 p.m. And if you look up your website, the Papa Network has a whole bunch of gateways. They have Echolink. They have D-Star and such. I have my own little question for Jeff. I was trying to listen into the net this Friday, And I'm not sure if the net didn't meet this Friday or my connection to the Papa network wasn't quite working, because I couldn't raise any signals on the D-Star gateway that I was using. So you know if that was working Friday night?
You know, it's a good question, Roy. The X-reflector that you went in through on 12 Alpha, well, first off, did you go in through the X-reflector 12 Alpha? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's the thing that it's called on my device is XRF 12 Alpha.
You know, sometimes that does not get hooked up. I'm not sure why it falls through the cracks. If you come in and if you came into Recolink or, you know, DMR or even P25, definitely, or All-Star, they were definitely working. We had a really good net last Friday night, as a matter of fact. Back to you.
Oh, well, what can I tell you? Usually I have a connection. This was a very strange episode. What happens is I run it through a recorder on my Shack computer. I use Blue DV, so I use the D-Star portion of Blue DV to get there. So, because my Echo Link is tied up to something else that I'm doing for another club, and I don't have All-Star. So I got to scratch my head and think of a kind of a bypass in case it goes out. It came back on. I mean, I think about 6 hours later, I was picking up signals from that gateway. So it was just a temporary glitch, I guess.
Okay, yeah, it sounds like it's temporary. We're on DMR and P25 also. Yeah, I'm sorry that you couldn't get through. My apologies. That happens again. Just try to send me an email or something like that so I can take a look at it, find out what's going on. Thank you.
Okay, very good. And I still it would be a nice thing if you could arrange with someone to archive those nets. I mean, I do I have a technical net on another repeater, KC2RC. I archive those, and occasionally I send archive copies over to Mike of amateurradio.tv for this technical net. It's nice to have copies. You never know when people need to kind of check back on something that they scribbled down illegibly, and now they'd like a second chance to write it down properly.
Yeah, so I heard somebody there, but I couldn't make out what they were saying. That's an excellent idea. I think we're archived on Broadcastify for that time. I think I looked at it one time just to see what was there, and I think it was archived on Broadcastify.
Okay, I'll have to check that out. That was Rich, W2BZ. I think he was asking what the talk group was on DMR, and I think you mentioned it was 327?
The talk group is 31078. That's the one that ties into our analog, and that's where the net is.
Okay, very good. Is that Brandmeister or is that another DMR group?
It is Brandmeister. I don't think we tie into the others, but it's definitely Brandmeister.
Okay, very good. I'll have to scribble it down in a little post-it note in case my main D-Star Link XRX 12 Alpha fails me. I can pull back to DMR. So what's your question or your topic or comment for tonight, Jeff?
Well, on the last net, of course it's on the last net, we had a guy that's doing QRP with a 705 and the ICOM 705, and he was getting frustrated because basically he's expecting the same performance out of it as the 100-watt rig. But he did bring up a question about Alex loops, which ties into the other loops that, you know, people have been using. And Phil and I, Phil is my counterpart at K6UJO, we're not that familiar with the loop antennas. I've never used one. I guess he hasn't either, just essentially what we read. What is generally the power that they can broadcast on the Alex loop? And, you know, roughly, do you have an idea how efficient they are? Because, you know, you can hear, I guess, but we're wondering about, you know, him using that to, you know, transmit. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, well, usually called a magnetic loop. It's a very short loop. It's usually about a tenth of a wave and can be even shorter, whereas a full loop has completely different characteristics. Matter of fact, one of my first antennas was a receive magnetic loop. DX Engineering still kind of sells it. They bought it out from a guy retiring. Magnetic loops are very nice in some ways and terrible in other ways. Because they're very short, they have an exceedingly high Q. And so in order to tune them, if you change by just, you know, 10, 20 kilocycles, you basically have to start almost from scratch tuning them. They do not have a very wide bandwidth, again, because of the very high Q. And also, because of the very high Q, the tuning capacitor, a magnetic loop is basically a shortened loop with a variable capacitor breaking up the circle, if you will. And you tune it by adjusting the capacitance of the variable capacitor. Then you usually have a smaller loop as a driven inductor. So you feed the power into a very small loop. It inductively is coupled to the larger loop, and you tune it with a variable capacitor. Because of the high Q, a transmitter power that's say 100 watts presents to those plates with 100 watts times the Q of the magnetic loop, which unless you buy a very high quality capacitor will have a voltage breakdown and will ruin a lot of things in your setup. So the expense and the limiter to how much power you can put into a magnetic loop is the power, the voltage rating, the voltage breakdown rating of the variable capacitors. There are people who use butterfly capacitors. They use air capacitors. But if you really want to run high power, you need something like a vacuum variable capacitor. And as it sounds, it's a capacitor that's encased in glass. The air is sucked out of it. And so the breakdown voltage is much, much higher than an air capacitor. So you kind of have to magnetic loops have different specs for transmission voltage. Most magnetic loops really can't go farther than, 80 watts, 70, 60 watts, and some of the less expensive ones can only do 20 watts. There are massive monster magnetic loops with enormous capacitors that can run near legal. But those are really expensive. So was that what you were looking for?
Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Oops, I timed out the repeater.
Boy, you got up to the massive loops, WS2X.
Okay, very good. So I was close to the end. I was just going to say that most magnetic loops have reasonably priced variable capacitors, and so their breakdown voltage limits them to, 50, 60 watts. You can get large ones or ones with repurposed vacuum capacitors that can go into the hundreds of watts. So it's more how much you're willing to spend and how much real estate you have. Otherwise, magnetic loops, I think, are great in that they don't require length elevation. 10 feet off the ground will suffice as long as you don't have any local objects blocking the radiation path. So except for the high Q and the problems tuning it, I think it's a great design for an antenna.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That gave me some good information. Go on. Definitely not a good choice for this guy. I think it's almost from bad to worse. So we've been trying to help him with, high gain antennas, like, 52-foot wire or 88-foot wire, two of my favorites. And they hit up about 8 to 10 dB of gain on those off to the sides at about 33 feet high. So we've been trying that. I think I just told him I didn't know much, but I think he'll be going from bad to worse if he went with that loop, and he'd be even more frustrated. Okay, Roy, thank you very much for your help. Much appreciated. AB6MB.
You're welcome, Jeff. It's really not a high-gain antenna design. There is nodes on either side. It's at right angles to, looking through the loop. You have a little bit of gain on the sides. They're symmetrical. So you're putting out as much behind you as in front of you. So there are probably better high gain antennas. It's good for people who want to travel light, because those things you can set up and put up and take down very quickly. You don't have to climb over trees and find places to hang odd wires. It's less scary to people who don't know what antennas are. If you're going to go into QRP, there's a reason why there are T-shirts that says life is too short for QRP. You have to understand that you're giving yourself a limitation and a challenge. And if you like challenges, then that's great. If you don't like challenges, well, then I'm not quite sure what the reason behind going QRP might be.
Yeah, I agree completely. I wasn't really heavy into QRP, but I understood the challenges and who I could work and not work. And like I said, he got the 705. He's had a, he loves the radio, but he said he was going to buy an amplifier, he's going to just sell that and go to another radio. So, hopefully he'll make a decision here. So thank you very much for your input. AV6MD.
You're welcome, Jeff. And the 705 is a very nice-looking radio. I wish I had an opportunity to play around with it. I was disappointed by the fact that if you hook it up to full power, you get 10 watts. And I kind of think that they really should have brought out a linear that would kind of bring it up to at least 100 that you could slap onto the side of it and it looked nice, but I think they said they were going to do that, and they haven't gotten around to doing it yet. But, like I've mentioned before, it's a software-defined radio, and I'm a big fan of that technology. So I'm hoping that I hear bigger and better things with the 705, but it certainly has very nice specs. It's very compact. It's sort of designed as an Elecraft KX2 or 3 killer. So I understand where they're coming from. I just wish they had more options at release. So thank you very much, Jeff. I appreciate your participation. Rich, I hope you can kind of maneuver your antenna a little bit. You're about 85% noise. Yes, that's what Jeff has told us. It's Brandmeister 31078. Okay, I think I heard most of that. Well, a full-wave loop is really different than a magnetic loop. Again, the magnetic loops are about one-tenth of a wavelength in circumference, and they have a whole bunch of different qualities. The full loop doesn't have that high Q. It has a wide bandwidth. You know, if you have a lot of real estate and you can do it, great. But as far as the magnetic loop, you know, I mean, it depends on how much of a tinkerer and experimenter you are. There are some guys who get a great deal of happiness out of building their own stuff. I've known people who've gone to the Home Depot and gotten some aluminum copper tubing that's usually designed, I think, for refrigerator water supplies. And they've hooked in, jury-rigged an air capacitor in the inside the loop, and had a decent ability of using it. It's always better, you know, if you could throw money at a problem, have guys who designed magnetic loops, built them, tested them, and they're pretty much proven. You don't have to tweak them. So it you have to pay more money, and you don't quite get the satisfaction of doing it yourself. The most important part of a magnetic loop, in my opinion, and I think from what you said, is the capacitor. Now, let me drop for a second because I don't want to time out again. Okay, very good. So it's the capacitor. That's the most important thing because it's going to determine the quality of the antenna. It's going to determine the transmission power capability. And also with the capacitor, you probably would want to have, if you're going to do it manually, if you're going to do it with a servo, then lots of luck. That's going to require some technology if you want to reinvent the wheel. There are companies out there that sell that type of equipment that checks the VisWah and adjusts it using a servo. But if you're going to manually adjust it, and you pretty much have to every time you change your frequency, even if it's a little bit on the same band, I would strongly urge that you get something like a vernier movement, which is a gear reduction movement, so that you can turn the variable capacitor very, very, very slowly. Because if you turn it too quickly, you could go right past the resonant point. So So it has a lot of problems, but it has some benefits. Again, it's small, it's compact, and it's not limited to high elevation like many other radiating antennas are. So it certainly is an interesting design if people are interested in it, and as long as they understand the limitations and such, I think it's a decent antenna to use. Yes, yes. It will get you on the air, and it takes up a lot less space and is less obvious to people around you. You know, I mean, if you throw an end-fed wire out the window or up on a tree, that'll get you on the air as well, but then you got the big wire sitting there, and eventually someone's going to pass by saying, do you have a permit for that stuff? And I assume if they see little loops, it doesn't scare them quite as much. So, yes, the one of the great benefits as any antenna that works is it works. It'll get you on the air. Okay, Rich, so we basically addressed your points. Okay, I couldn't make out all of that. There was something about the interport? Okay, I figured it out. I'm sorry. Rich has been very interested in NFTs, non-fungible tokens, and he's curious whether you guys out there know about it, care about it, have any kind of estimation of it. So that's his question for the general listeners of the Limark Technical Net. Is there anyone out there with any knowledge about non-fungible tokens, NFTs, any opinions, positive, negative, or in the middle? Well, Rich, I think you got your answer there, and I think my estimation was somewhat accurate.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, middle of texting here. Yeah, no, I know what they are. And so what is the actual question? If anybody has knowledge of what they are?
Yes, that was the question. I was discussing via phone on the subject, and I told Rich that I did not think that this would be a well-known phenomena on the technical net, but then I said the one guy that I thought would know what we were talking about would be Lou.
Yeah, so what's Rich's interest? So basically, you know, it's a digital contract almost. I think similar to blockchain, but you have rights or authorizations. You're the only one that... It's tied to you. Ownership is tied to you when you buy one of these things. It's also usually tied to a physical thing, like a piece of art or something like that. There's a lot of speculation, just like there, you know, there's usefulness, and then there's the speculation side, just like crypto. Crypto took a big crash, I think, this week because there's a lot of speculation, which brought up its price. But there's also utility in it. But a non-fungible token, means that it's tied ownership to you. It can be proven digitally. It's yours, and you have claims to ownership. The artwork itself can be duplicated, you know, so it's whatever. It's like bragging rights. And they do trade, you know, and people will pay up for them. So.
AC2GS. Yeah. If anyone's really interested, either in cryptocurrency or non-fungible tokens, I have links of both. The one that particularly discusses the history of cryptocurrency goes on for about 2 hours, but it's very interesting and very informative. So anyone interested in it, you know, it's a nice thing. You'll learn a lot from it. Non-fungible tokens don't necessarily give you anything, in my way of looking at it, other as bragging rights, because you can finagle, if you're selling an NFT, it's possible for you to not sell the copyright or the reproducibility or anything. It's up to the seller. What happens is you owning something, whatever it might be, is placed upon a publicly available database, the blockchain of something, usually like Ether cryptocurrency. So it's sort of bragging rights. For the most part, people can steal the digital art anytime that they want. And, again, a lot of the art, if you have the NFT for it, does not mean you can generate hard copies and sell them to people, because a lot of times it doesn't come with copyright at all. So it's a very weird, somewhat grifty, highly speculative. If you like gambling, this is probably something you should look into. If you don't like gambling, you should probably find better ways of spending your money. You know, there's the case of a guy who sold, I think, 10 years' worth of 3D animation graphics for $69 million in cryptocurrency. It was actually a guy who already owns a lot of cryptocurrency scams and was just pumping up the market, apparently, at the time. But, you know, there's a lot of strangeness going on. Everyone and their mother now is selling NFTs. So if you have nothing better to do, you might consider getting it if you can find a deal. The problem is something called gasoline. I think it's gas, which is the price you pay to mint the NFT on the Ethereum blockchain. So if you can find a cheap gas price, then, you know, people are stealing art from DeviantArt all the time. I think there was something like 85,000 pieces of art copied and sold as NFTs on sites. So it's a curious, interesting mess out there.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
What can I say? I'm just too talkative this evening.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
So there's some new crypto coming out which addresses the problem of using a lot of energy for mining the bitcoins and validating the transactions. The technique is done by consensus. It's a peer thing. I forgot the term. I was just going to look it up here. But it's not mining so much as a cooperative effort where you get a consensus from the group. And it's a peer method. And it doesn't use lots of energy. I'll look a little further, but I stumbled across that this week, so they're trying to address that.
Yeah, one of the big problems, there's a lot of problems, but one of the big problems is they use a method called proof of work, which means that people have to run a lot of computers crunching a lot of numbers to figure out the next entry into the blockchain. The problem with that is it requires a great deal of power and a lot of computational power as well. So you need either a lot of graphic processor units or ASICs, which are special computer circuits designed to optimize the algorithm. You need a lot of electrical power, and you need a lot of air conditioning. So if there was some kind of a geothermal power generator in the North Pole, that would be kind of the perfect thing. But that's proof of work. What Lou is discussing is proof of stake, which is a different type of technology in which how many tokens you already possess puts you at the top of the list of believable servers. The problem with both of these things is the whole concept of this cryptocurrency was to decentralize everything. But in the proof of work, there's only, China, I think at one point had 50% of all mining operations. So it wasn't decentralized. It was very centralized. And usually a very small percentage of people own a large percentage of any cryptocurrency. And so that's probably going to end up with the same centralized instead of decentralized server system. Yes, Wesley. Yeah, Wesley, I heard you earlier getting a mic check. So there are some people who think that you have a erratic mic connection. I tend not to think that. I think there's some guy somewhere out there who's just blanketing your carrier. So I'm not quite sure, but I barely got anything from that transmission. There are times where you're down by 25 decibels, and then there are times that you're silent.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
40% of mining of cryptocurrency operation is done in Kazakhstan because electricity is too cheap over there. So when there was turbulence, political turbulence in Kazakhstan, the cryptocurrency went down drastically.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, proof of stake. That's right. And talk about the unfortunate who may lose their password to their wallet. And what happens to all that crypto? I guess it just hides out in a black hole forever.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of problems. Lots of problems. Because of the nature of cryptocurrency, it's not like credit cards. If you buy something with your credit card and the guy never gives you anything, you could call up your credit company and reverse the charges. You can't reverse cryptocurrency. Once it's sent out, it's sent out. It can't be reversed. Also, just because you send it out doesn't mean it gets processed. Sometimes there is a big backup. Things like Bitcoin have a built-in limitation. It can only do 7 operations a second. So if the world is operating at more than 7 operations a second, which it very often does, it puts you in the queue. So it may take you 6-7 hours for your transaction to come through. I mean, think of yourself standing online with a credit card, and they put it through the slot, and they're waiting for the beep, and they wait 7 hours for the beep. And occasionally they drop it entirely. It gets lost in the ether of the Ethernet. So that's a problem. Another is exchange groups, banks that make life easier for you because you can exchange dollars for bitcoins and one bitcoin to another, usually are broken into by hackers all the time, and millions of dollars are lost. And that, in addition to when guys die or they misplace their password, it's gone. It's locked away. It's there's something called a cold wallet. Let me drop for a sec. There's two types of wallets where you keep your cryptocurrency. A hot wallet is something that's either on your computer or on a server someplace, and so it makes life much easier to do currency swaps and such. Then there are cold wallets in which you take all the information completely off servers, off your computer. It's sitting on a USB stick, and the USB stick is not plugged into anything most of the time. So that's a cold wallet. And then there's things like burning coins in which you put it in a wallet that's public and you promise not to take the money out ever again. So you're decreasing the money supply using that method. So it's a lot of interesting mathematical stuff. Programmers kind of love it because of that. I can't imagine a real economist who knows his stuff who would suggest it to anyone. It's an interesting phenomenon. There's nothing really behind cryptocurrency. It's an artificial scarcity. So you got an artificial scarcity and an artificial value and a limited number. Bitcoin has 21 million, I think, coins, and most of them are stuck away someplace because if people actually tried to use it, my guess would be the price point per coin would plummet. Okay, Rich wanted me to explain what miners are. I think Wesley mentioned Kazakhstan is one of the principal miners these days. It used to be China. China threw them all out because they were running out of electricity. They've had rotating brownouts and blackouts in China for the last 4 or 5 months. It has something weirdly to do with them getting back at Australia. Australia is one of the sources of coal that they use for a lot of electricity generation. But nevertheless, mining is simply the act of doing the computational proof of work to generate the hash codes that go into the blockchain. The blockchain is just a ledger. Think of it as an Excel sheet with some authentication slathered on. So the authentication is due to computers crunching numbers until they have acceptable results. They add the results to the blockchain. They get a small portion of a Bitcoin as payment of their work, and life goes on. The problem is, as time goes on, the algorithm gets more and more difficult to run. So every 2 weeks, someone who has something to do with Bitcoin tweaks the algorithm and makes it a little bit simpler. They have to adjust the algorithm so that every 10 minutes, someone can come up with the proper blockchain hash code and such. So it's a real contrivance. I mean, if you're a programmer, it's loads of fun to think about. If you're an economist, I would hide under a bed somewhere.
KD2VHT.
Say again, Rich, I didn't quite make that out. I'm not quite sure what the question was, if it was a hippie type of thing. I think it's more an anarcho-capitalist sort of thing. It's a libertarian gone totally insane sort of thing. I mean, the original concept that goes way back to a white paper was about decentralizing the economy, taking the monetary supply out of countries and placing it in the void and spreading it out so it was decentralized, the entire world. You know, millions of servers through the world are a part of the monetary system and no one can finagle it. And that's really has no relationship to reality of what it's become. It is pretty much a highly centralized, decentralized device right now. And, you know, as Wesley mentioned, Kazakhstan, if they have an eruption, all of a sudden you can't exchange coins anymore, or at least it's going to take a while for the other people to kind of decompress the backload. So it's a mess. I mean, it's hippy dippy type of stuff, I guess, but it's not going to work. Okay, once again, not quite sure. You're talking about Selden. I understand that there are some times that you make it into Selden with far less noise. Right now, it's really noisy. It's about 90%, so I'm barely making it out. And also, I think earlier you mentioned people make money. Yeah, well, there's some kind of nasty comment that some people describe the concept of the last fool. So the idea is you buy something that's overpriced with the hope that there's a fool out there willing to pay you even more money for it. And the idea is you don't want to be the last fool. You want to be the next to last fool is the trick. So I don't know if it's last fool or musical chairs going on. But there are people who make money. There's a lot of grifters making money. There's a couple of guys out there who just accidentally are making money. And certainly, if you got in at the very beginning, then you could just play with it because it didn't cost you much of anything at the beginning. But more and more people are probably getting into it and probably losing money. I don't really see a great future. It's kind of like kids, because usually it's younger people. When you're 60, 70, you tend not to do cryptocurrency, I don't think. But, you know, for the 20s and the 30-year-olds, it's their version of being day traders.
KG2RY.
You're welcome, Rich. David, you wanted to say something?
QSO, good evening. There is a man from India who became a billionaire dealing in Bitcoin.
Okay, there are a lot of guys who on the books are billionaires. If they liquidated the Bitcoins that they own, chances are they wouldn't be billionaires. But, yeah, matter of fact, that's probably the guy I was talking about who bought the $69 million worth of non-fungible tokens.
QSL, and he also bought an auction. Was it $60, $70, $80 million digital art work that was stored on some kind of token?
Yeah, he bought for $69 million. He bought I think his name is Beeple or the weird name he goes by is Beeple. He's a 3D animator. He had this thing where every day he did a little quick simple 3D animation. and he posted it to a website. So I think he did that for 10 years, and he grouped them all together and sold them as a non-fungible token. Now, when you buy or sell non-fungible tokens, it doesn't necessarily mean that this guy got a hard drive with all of those files. It just means that he got bragging rights to it and a link where it is available on a website where anyone could just right-click and download the entire collection, all $69 million worth of it, but they don't get the bragging rights.
QSL, it sounds like it could be sort of like a marketplace. He can post this artwork on the Internet, and he could ask for more money than what he paid.
Well, that's the thing. Well, again, they're not selling the artwork. The artwork is readily available. You can download it anytime you want for nothing. You can, though, buy the bragging rights from this Indian gentleman who bought it for $69 million, if you're willing to pay him, I guess, more than $69 million. But then that just gives you an entry on Ethereum's blockchain that said, David now owns this bunch of 3D art. The idea is that you buy and sell these things. Again, that you find someone else who has, say, $71 million to waste, and they buy it from you. Now, there's a cute, interesting, again, software guy type of a layer of amusing things with NFTs. You can build an NFT so that if I sell it to you and then you sell it for more money to someone else, I get a piece of that extra gain that you get. Depending upon how you write the smart contract for the NFT, I may get 10% of the markup that you make selling it to the next guy. So that's smart contracts, which we can talk about, because smart contracts is loads of fun and crazy as hell.
I tell you, Roy, you know, this whole thing makes me feel a little bit uneasy. You know, when I make an artwork, when some artwork is created, you know, it's tangible. You know, it's either on a panel or in a frame, on a piece of paper, on a canvas, you know, whatever. And now, you know, this idea of digital artworks that aren't printed, that aren't rendered, you know, they're just inside of some hard disk.
I agree with you. I mean, ultimately, they're placed on a third party server that theoretically is going to be around for a while. But as we all know, you know, things live, things die, things break, things get lost. So just because it's available on a web server today doesn't necessarily mean 20 years from now it'll be on that web server. And you can't change the non-fungible token. So the non-fungible token is pointing to a particular web server under a particular file name. You could just change the file name and it's gone. You still have the NFT, but it's not even connected to art. That plus, this has been such a grifting scheme that people kind of were slowed down by people who were actually artists. So they've gone around, and they don't bother with the artists anymore. Like I said, they go to DeviantArt, they download every piece of art that they can find there, and they coin them as NFTs. That's one group. Another group of strange people is they'll take some really crummy, simple scrawlings that anyone could do in a day who has any art ability, and they'll generate a large number of random graphics based upon changing the background and changing a couple little extras in the picture. So they'll generate, using 10 scrawled images and some extras, 1,000 images, coin them all, and try and sell them all. And people have done that and made hundreds of thousands of dollars.
drive back.
I'm sorry, you're about 60% noise. Could you ID yourself?
Give my good pictures anymore. I have a bunch of trailers, but that's it, video trailers.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a shame. I think it would be nice if it could be implemented in some way, although I'm not quite sure the best way. What some people who have actual physical art do is they will kind of couple the NFT with the physical art. So what they'll tell people is, look, I have an image on my Photoshop. I will link it as an NFT, and in addition, I will mail you a hard copy of the image so that you can put it on your wall, which is not really an NFT, but you know, I think that would be one of the good uses. Right now, I think the majority of NFTs are as speculative to just try and find some guy that you can sell it to, unfortunately.
QSL, Roy. But, you know, maybe this is good. This might be good because original artworks be worth much more. You know, you get like a vintage Cibachrome or some collage mixed media, and you have all the materials and all of the parts to it, you know, can make it much more valuable than, you know, these other kinds of art.
Well, that would be my hope, because that would be a legitimate exercise. You would get something. It would help the artist out. Whereas that isn't apparently where the market is going. The market seems to be going in the kind of grifter's end. A lot of game companies are going to sell screenshots of their games or character art as virtual things. You don't get any hard copy. And again, I think the majority of these people are not people who appreciate art, but they're guys who just appreciate being in the group, and also guys who think that they could make money off of this. So, which should be the primary impetus to collecting art. I think if a piece of art speaks to you and you get something out of it, then that's great. But, you know, I could sort of see, you know, if you could find the Mona Lisa really cheap, you know, you can turn it around and make a lot of money. But that's not what most people do with art. So, I don't know. I think this is kind of screwing around with art. I think this is just another grift. There's way too many grifts out there. As I grow older, I discover more and more of them.
KZ2FIU, please.
Silently, George.
Wasn't it Will Rogers? By land, they ain't making any more of that.
Well, as a real estate broker's license holder, you know that very well. But as you also know, that although they're not making any more land, sometimes land is worth more than other times. It doesn't always go uppity, uppity, up. Sometimes it goes sideways, and occasionally it goes down. And, you know, the mortgage fiasco that we had back in the the first decade of the 21st century should kind of give people pause.
Okay, convert your dollars to cryptocurrency and service. Land.
Yeah, but if something's harder to get, isn't it worth more?
Well, I mean, that's a generalization, and that's part of supply and demand. If the supply is low, the price goes up, and scarcity is another way of saying a low supply. But scarcity by itself isn't the whole picture. There's a lot of things that are scarce, but no one particularly wants them, even though they're scarce. I could scribble down my signature And it's scarce, you know, except for checks and contracts and other things. I don't think anyone would be particularly interested in buying my signature anywhere, but it's scarce.
QSL. Well, you know, it depends on what you want to get. If you're an artist, you like making art, and you don't care if other people like it. And if they like it, great. They don't like it, it's okay. And beyond that, you know, if somebody wants to obsess the money,